From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Perhaps we've grown less sentimental about cars than we were in the era when Buzz and Todd drove around America in their 1960 Corvette on the TV series Route 66. On today's Fresh Air, we look at automobile design for the new millennium. We'll talk with Christopher Mount, who organized the Museum of Modern Art's current show on the cars of the next century. And we meet Chuck Pelley, who designs BMWs. He's been designing cars for 30 years. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg reads the new edition of the classic usage book, The Elements of Style. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. Thousands of people in South Texas are without power after a visit by Hurricane Brett. Brett is now a tropical storm, weakening as it moves across southern Texas toward Mexico. Brett did not have the punch that weather experts feared when it made landfall last night, but rain is still falling, giving rise to fears of flooding. People in the Laredo area on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border are being told to move to higher ground. Residents of South Texas who fled before the storm hit the Gulf Coast are still in Red Cross shelters. NPR's Wade Goodwin has more from San Antonio.
More than 10,000 people fled the Texas coast and have taken up refuge in American Red Cross shelters. And many of those I spoke to say they fled not so much because of the official warnings that were given out, but because 29 years ago, Hurricane Celia slammed into Corpus Christi dead on. That was a hurricane that was a lot like Brett, one that built very quickly and suddenly, and it destroyed or damaged about 90% of downtown Corpus Christi and killed 12 people. And many of the people I talked to today were children back then and told harrowing stories about what it was like for them. And so they were taking no chances this time and decided to seek shelter in San Antonio, which is about 3 hours north of Corpus Christi.
NPR's Wade Goodwin. Foreign rescue teams packed up their listening equipment and began pulling out of Turkey as the relief effort switched from finding earthquake survivors to aiding those already out of the rubble. Recognizing the near impossible odds of finding more survivors, rescue efforts were changing focus to concentrate on helping the estimated 200,000 people who are homeless. The California Supreme Court has overturned Proposition 5. It's a voter-approved state ballot initiative that supported gambling on Indian reservations. But the fight over tribal gaming in California is far from over, NPR's Stephen Rosenfeld reports.
Proposition 5 was the most expensive ballot fight in U.S. history. Last year, California Native American tribes spent more than $70 million on the measure to preserve tribal gambling. They sponsored the initiative because then-Republican Governor Pete Wilson would not negotiate with them. Prop 5 was overwhelmingly approved last November, even though Las Vegas interests spent $26 million to try to defeat it. But California tribes knew it would not hold up in court, as the state's constitution barred expanded gambling. Still, they hoped it would postpone a government shutdown of some casinos. California's high court indeed ruled Prop 5 violated the state constitution. But the tribes anticipated that and are now circulating another initiative to change the constitution. That measure may come before voters as soon as next winter. Stephen Rosenfeld, NPR News, San Francisco.
Another record high in the Dow today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 200 points to close at 11,299. The Nasdaq was up 71 at 2719. This is NPR News. Early next year, two Libyans suspected of blowing up Pan Am Flight 103 will be tried by a panel of Scottish judges. The jumbo jet was destroyed over Scotland in 1988, killing 270 people. Today in Washington, a Scottish prosecutor told relatives of the victims how the suspects will be tried. NPR's Ted Clark has more.
The relatives who came to Washington expressed a range of emotions. Some were pleased there will finally be a trial. Others voiced concern that Libyan leaders who may have ordered the bombing could escape prosecution. Some family members say the U.S. State Department hasn't worked hard enough to bring those responsible for the bombing to justice. Department spokesman James Foley says he respectfully disagrees with that accusation.
We are proud, as is the government of the United Kingdom, of our dogged efforts over the years to keep up the pressure and to produce this result where we're going to have a real trial.
Foley said the trial must produce whatever evidence is relevant to find out who was involved. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
Researchers are working on a vaccine they hope will block the urge to use drugs. A pharmacologist at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences says the designer antibodies could revolutionize emergency treatment for PCB and amphetamines. Illegal drugs sneak past the body's immune system because they're made of molecules too tiny to be detected. Researchers are trying to create an antibody that would set off the immune system's alarms, cutting the effects of the drug before it reaches the brain. And researchers think the government should be boosting the recommended dose of vitamin C. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
You women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along.
Our cars have changed since the days of the Rocket 88. If you're wondering what directions cars are headed in for the new millennium, you'll find some interesting answers in an unexpected place, the Museum of Modern Art in New York. 9 new cars embodying fresh approaches to automotive design are on display. My guest Christopher Mount organized the exhibition. He's assistant curator in the museum's Department of Architecture and Design. The show is called Different Roads, Automobiles for the Next Century, but it's about cars that are already here. It's not a futuristic show.
Right. Well, that was something we very much wanted to avoid. We wanted to avoid those futuristic cars that you see at car shows. The ones that you can sail or the ones that can fly, because that technology is really not practical and probably will perhaps never happen. I remember when I was younger, I always assumed that by this point, we would all be flying around in automobiles. If you think of George Jetson and his flying automobile, that's just not going to happen. And in a sense, the future of the automobile is far more sober or far more somber. In a sense, the automobile has created certain problems. The user has created certain problems, and those things are going to have to be thought about or dealt with by the industry.
Let's look at some of the cars in the show. Let's start with the Daimler Chrysler Smart Car. Would you describe it?
Yeah, it's a small two-seat car, very, very small. It's intended as a commuter car. It's intended for people who live inside or outside a place like London or Paris, even New York City, primarily as a second car, something that you might use to pick up some groceries or commute to a job. It's actually half the space of a European parking space. So you can park it, instead of parallel to the street, actually perpendicular, and you can fit two cars into that. The German designer said he wanted to make a car that fit two people in a case of beer, and that's about what it fits. But it's a rethinking, and what's important about the Smart is that it's a rethinking of the automobile. The designer comes up with this problem. Okay, I live in Paris. Paris is difficult to drive around, or I live outside Paris. How do I get into my job? And so it's a new situation, a new problem. Obviously, when Paris was designed, no one thought about the automobile. This is, again, intended as a second car. You wouldn't pick up the kids at the softball game or move lumber or things like that. But this is a very, with more and more family members working, this is I wouldn't say quite a new function of the automobile, but a new direction in the automobile to a certain degree.
Now, second cars are to be cheap so that there's a chance you can afford them. Is this car, affordable?
Yeah, it's about $9,000 when you convert the money. It's about $9,000.
Are there any design innovations in this car that have enabled it to be that small?
Basically, the engine is put, you basically sit almost on top of the engine, so you don't have that long trunk in the front. Most automobiles are designed in what's called three boxes. You have a front box for the engine, a middle box for the passenger, and a back box for a trunk. This car actually is made out of one box. It's made with an advanced space frame, a sort of computer-designed space frame, which is basically a metal frame which protects the passenger. It has plastic panels, which if you decide you don't like, you can take to a smart center and change for about $700 in about 2 hours. So if you decide you don't like the color of this car, you can change it, or you know, if you get somebody new in your house who doesn't like it, you can make it a yellow car or whatever. And it has this... It was designed originally by Swatch, or it was put together by Swatch and Mercedes-Benz. And as the Swatch watch has sort of, made the Swiss watch more democratic, this automobile is trying to make automobiles more democratic, in a sense, by making them simpler, cheaper, more user-friendly, in a sense.
I'm going to ask you to choose another small car in your show and describe some of the innovations in that.
Most of the automobiles in the show are small. Most of them are gas efficient, lighter. Many of them have hybrid engines, electric engines. We have an Audi AL2, which is made primarily of aluminum. And that is a new material, it's not a new material, but the use of it is relatively new in automobiles, which is lighter. Makes the car, again, more efficient. I mean, in a sense, the issues, we don't have to. In a sense, what the show is really ultimately about is that efficient, responsible automobiles can also be likable, be appealing, and be charming in their own way. In a sense, good design can be affordable. And that's always been a major theme in terms of modern design, in terms of 20th century design, and in terms of the Museum of Modern Art. We've always promoted design for the middle classes, design that was, again, affordable and appealing.
You mentioned that one of the kind of cutting-edge things in cars now is an aluminum body instead of a steel mm-hmm. body. Aluminum's lighter, therefore the car could be more fuel-efficient, doesn't take that much fuel to move the car. What about its safety, though? I mean, does aluminum hold up as well in a crash as steel right. does?
Well, that's a good question. It's a question everybody asks about these automobiles: is are they safer or are they safe enough? There are many different answers and many different sort of aspects of that. Many of these automobiles are sold in Europe, where most automobiles are smaller. The problem with automobile safety is the differential. You know, if a large 18-wheeler hits a car, the person in the car is in big trouble. And again, probably the safest car is the largest, heaviest car you can think of. An old Cadillac, perhaps, is perhaps the safest car. But these cars are much, much safer than the old small economy cars of the past. Many of them have multiple airbags. Many of them have these metal space frames, which again protect the passenger, sort of envelop the passenger, very much like a racing car does. And many of them are designed by computers, which have basically innovated new ways of putting the engine places so that it doesn't crash into the passengers, new placement of mechanical parts. And some of the cars are, you know, have an extensive amount of plastic. Plastic, believe it or not, is actually relatively bouncy, which is interesting. It absorbs the energy of a crash slightly differently than steel or things like that. They're actually safer than the old cars, the old economy cars of the past.
I'd like you to describe the Fiat Multipla and its approach to space.
Yeah, that's very interesting. The Multipla was actually designed from the inside out, which is very rare with automobile design. The designer wanted to fit 6 passengers comfortably in this car, and it has something like the interior space of a station wagon or a minivan with the exterior space of something like a Ford Festiva or something, you know, on a very small exterior, what the auto industry calls a footprint. But the interior is quite remarkable, and it has this almost bulbous shape. which again allows for a certain amount of headroom, a certain amount of shoulder space. The passengers sit on top of the engine or almost on top of the engine. And the automobile designer has managed this really anthropomorphic kind of design. It always looks a bit like a reptile to me, but it's in a fascinating automobile in terms of the use of space. And again, you know, you don't have to have, again, small cars don't have to necessarily be about sacrifice. You can get a small exterior footprint, but still have a lot of room on the inside.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Melt. He's the curator of the show Different Roads, Automobiles for the Next Century. It's at the Museum of Modern Art through September 21st. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more about cars. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Melt, and he curated the show Different Roads, Automobiles for the Next Century, which is now on exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Now, one thing that you can't really see that well on the cars is the engines and how they work. I guess, Right. Can people open up the hoods and look inside?
No.
No test
drives,
huh?
We can't let people inside either, yeah.
So tell us about some of the innovations in the engines in the cars that you're exhibiting.
Sure. Well, you know, I think that this exhibition, when we were putting it together, this exhibition really, what we discovered was that there was a real rethinking in terms of the automobile, real redesign or rethinking about the automobile. And one of the essential places that this is happening is in the power plants, the power sources for these cars. We have an electric car in the show, and we have two hybrid cars, which have both an electric motor and a gasoline engine. And as far as I'm concerned, this is really the near future of the automobile, or the near future of the next power plant, so to speak. It has, as I said, an electric motor and a gasoline engine, and it has all of the good things of electric and all of the good things of a gasoline engine without really any of the bad. It's a wonderful compromise, in a sense. You get incredible gas mileage. The Toyota can go from New York to Chicago on one tank of gas, and the Honda can go from New York to Detroit on one tank of gas. You get something like 70 miles per gallon. The cars are very low in terms of emissions of pollution or smog, which is wonderful. And they solve many of the problems that we have in places like Los Angeles or Mexico City or even places like Tokyo or Hong Kong.
Now, how do these hybrid engines work? Where you're using a combustion engine and
Right.
an electric motor at the same time? Do they work at the same time together?
Sometimes. It seems why I think this took so long to develop is, in a sense, because it seems so impractical. Why have a car with two engines in it? But what's remarkable is that the engines go on and off depending on what the circumstances are. And I've driven a number of them, and they're absolutely seamless. Something like the Toyota begins in electric so that it's completely silent. It's not emitting any pollution. And this is a problem because most cars, where they emit the most pollution is while they're idling at a stoplight or idling, and from 0 to 30. That's where you get the major amount of pollution. This car uses electric in those circumstances. When you get up to 30 miles per hour and you need more speed, you need more power, the gasoline engine comes in and starts to power the car also. And then you have both working. And the gasoline engine goes on and off as you need it. You never have to recharge the electric batteries.
Why not? Does it charge like a regular battery does?
It charges itself. The gasoline engine charges it. And it is also charged when you're braking. Believe it or not, when you brake a car, a certain amount of energy is produced. And that is siphoned back into the battery, into the batteries that are included in these cars.
Can you feel the car shifting from the electric to the combustion engine?
No, you would think you would. You would think you would have a certain bumping or groans or some sort of terrible sounds, but and you absolutely can't. You have a computer monitor in one of the cars that tells you what is going on, and when you first drive it, you have to make sure that you don't watch the computer monitor too closely.
Now, why does the electric engine still need the combustion engine as a companion in the car?
Well, to recharge the electric batteries, to recharge the electric cells, that's really the only reason you need it. The there's another automobile on the show, which is just an electric automobile produced by General Motors, which is the first electric car produced by a major manufacturer. And the drawback right now with electric automobiles is that they can only go 60 to 80 miles on a charge, and then you have to plug them in again. And many people find that impractical. Those kinds of cars are really, again, practical for things like commuting. Electric cars are probably also practical for things like city buses, postal trucks, those kinds of things.
You know, on the one hand, you see like the wave of the future for the urban cars being the mini car. But at the same time, a lot of people are opting for big cars, for sports utility vehicles. How come you don't have any of the SUV-type cars in your show?
Well, that's a very good question. What we're trying to look at is again, the affordable cars that deal with those issues, with pollution, overcrowding, an efficient use of a finite amount of fuel, and then, in a sense, new technologies, new materials, new power plants, a new use of space, as I talked about the Multipla, new designing of interior space. There isn't much in terms of SUVs where you see innovations in these areas. Most of the real exciting innovation in terms of design, materials, power plants, all those things I talked about, are happening at the economy level, are happening at the small, affordable level. And again, if you think about it, the consumer who buys these cars is probably much more concerned about gas prices, much more concerned about crowding or having an efficient car than perhaps somebody who drives a large SUV. Many of the features in these cars, the use of plastic, the use of space frames, the use of the hybrid engines, can be applied to SUVs and probably will be. One designer said to me that he really thought the hybrid engine with both the electric motor and the gasoline engine, the first place we were really going to see it in America was on an SUV, because SUVs now get, I guess, 10 to 12 miles per gallon. With a hybrid system, you could probably get it up to 25, maybe 30 miles per gallon, and suddenly you have not only a large SUV, but a pretty gas-efficient SUV.
Well, I know when I was growing up, what you were supposed to aspire to was the luxury car.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant it was going to be big and with all the latest, you know, push-button gizmos inside. And, of course, it would be advertised with a very wealthy, seductive-looking woman posed mm-hmm. in front of it. What do you think cars are expected to say now about the people who own them? I mean, like when a few decades ago, it was very clear that, you know, a car was supposed to make a statement about who you are. And I'm not sure if cars are still perceived as being that bound up with the personality of the driver.
Well, that's very interesting. And there is a real difference between the way Europeans see their automobiles and the way Americans see their automobiles. Europeans, even very wealthy Europeans, often drive smaller, inexpensive cars. There's a wonderful advertisement, I believe, from the 60s for Fiat that says, drive what Enzo Ferrari drives. And there's a picture of Enzo Ferrari getting into his small Fiat. Europeans, because of legislation, because of high gasoline prices, tend to drive more simple, affordable cars, and they tend to be less invested in it as a mirror or as a reflection or as a symbol of their self-worth, in a sense, or a sign of their self-worth. Also, I think it's interesting because European cultures tend to be much more hierarchical than American culture. Americans, on the other hand, seem to find some status and some of their or put more worth into their automobile and what their automobile looks like and the price of their automobile and those kinds of things.
You had some design problems of your own, I'm sure, to deal with in putting the show together. Where are you actually displaying the cars in the Museum of Modern Art?
The museum, the cars are actually in the sculpture garden at the museum. And it happens to fit very nicely because we are, in a sense, trying to make this show very very much a forum for people to see these cars. So the whole idea of having the cars in a square, in a very public space where people can sit and think about them, I always think about, you know, ancient Rome or ancient Greece, is really quite wonderful, and it's a wonderful combination, I think, of having these in the garden and having people to be able to look and discuss them in a sense.
I know that it was an earlier show that was dedicated to the aesthetics of cars, to car as moving sculpture, and this show is a much more practical-oriented show. But what do you think are some of the best-looking cars on the road now?
You know, there are, I happen to like English cars. There are absolutely, you know, wonderful Jaguars. I happen to like sports cars. I mean, I happen to be a sucker for Ferraris and Aston Martins, and there's a small English company called TVR. You know, the new Audi TT, I think, is very interesting looking. That's a sort of a radical new design. I happen to like the very sculptural, sort of sinuous shapes that look like they're moving, that look like they're about to pounce, in a sense.
Do you have a favorite all-time car?
I happen to, one of the cars that is one of my favorites is the Jaguar E-Type. I think that is probably one of the most beautiful cars ever made, and we acquired one 4 or 5 years ago.
But for the permanent collection?
Yeah, for the permanent collection. And I still look at it every day, and I still think to myself, there, you know, that really is almost a perfect automobile.
Christopher Mount is the curator of the exhibition Different Roads, Automobiles for the Next Century at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. We'll talk more about the car of the next century in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go. Riding along in my automobile, I was anxious to tell her the way I feel. So I told her softly and sincere, and she leaned and whispered in my ear. Cuddling more and driving slow with no particular place to go. Place to go. So we parked way out on the Kokomo. The night was young and the moon was gold. So we both decided to take a stroll. Can you imagine the way I felt? I couldn't unfasten a...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Petopia.com, offering food, advice, toys, treats, and supplies delivered to pets and their people nationwide. On the web at Petopia.com. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at REEL.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Bantam Books, publishers of Victory in Our Schools by Major General John Stanford, a book outlining his essentials for improving our schools. Available in trade paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the car that knows you, your likes and dislikes. We talk with car designer Chuck Kelly, and we hear more from Christopher Mount, who organized the car exhibition currently at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg reads the new edition of the classic usage book, The Elements of Style. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Christopher Mount. He organized the new car show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. The show features 9 cars with innovative styling and engines. Most of the cars on the show are very small, designed for commuting in crowded cities. Are most of those very small cars in the Museum of Modern Art show available in the United States? I know a lot of them, several of them, have been manufactured for European use.
Some of them, something like the General Motors electric car is available, the EV1 is available, the Honda in the show will be available here, the Toyota will be available here, and actually, in a sense, the Toyota is really not that small. It really is the size of a Corolla or a Camry. The Mini may become available in this country soon. The Fiat is not, and the Audi maybe in the next year or two. So some of the cars are and some of them not. Bringing many of these cars to this country, and some of them will come to this country, is problematic because many of the cars have standard transmissions, and Americans tend to like to drive automatics. Another issue in terms of bringing these cars is getting them to pass safety laws that we have in this country, and it's not so much that these cars can't pass them as it is that it costs the manufacturer so much money to go through the testing of many of these automobiles that sometimes it's just not worthwhile to bring them to this country.
Well, speaking of safety, I mean, these small cars are particularly well suited for urban driving, but there's more and more of those big SUVs in cities now, and it's really problematic. Just as practically, we ought to be moving towards smaller cars in cities. We're up against colliding with big SUVs, so it becomes more dangerous.
Right. Well, you know, this country, we Americans tend to like big cars, and that's fine. And Americans can drive big cars as long as fuel prices are low. Fuel prices recently, I think it was this spring, gasoline was actually selling less than bottled water in many parts of this country. That's not true in Asia. That's not true in Europe. So people tend to want to drive smaller cars. Also, the streets, most European cities are smaller. Tokyo, certainly, the streets are smaller. And a lot of large SUVs really won't fit in places like that. I think that you will only begin to really sell efficient smaller cars in this country when and if gasoline prices ever go up in this country.
The function of your show is to show the future of really practical and aesthetically pleasing cars. Have there been any people who said, well, why don't you just come up with alternatives to the car altogether? You know, we should be, the car is too much dominating our culture. We should be finding ways of getting rid of cars, not just of redesigning them.
Yeah, there are those. There are those who say that we really should get rid of the automobile altogether and start using bicycles and public forms of transportation. The problem is that with that is that in this country, that's really impractical. What would you do in a place like Los Angeles if you had to ride a bicycle? Certainly public transportation can be improved, and certainly in a place like Los Angeles. But bicycles are practical in, you know, Amsterdam and Copenhagen, but aren't necessarily in Montana. What we've tried to do with this exhibition is we've tried to make sure that people keep their automobiles, keep the sense of freedom, keep the sense of even liberty, if you will, with these cars, and keep the automobile, and you don't have to get rid of that. All you have to do is just change it a little bit, and it's not even really so much a sacrifice. These cars are not really as much of a sacrifice as people think they are, even though they're much more efficient and much more practical. They really aren't, again, the old economy cars of the past. These cars are likable in and of themselves and likable regardless of price. And that's important for the public to understand, that we can all keep our automobiles. They just have to be changed a little bit.
Well, in a moment, we're going to meet the head of DesignWorks USA, Chuck Pelley, and he designs cars for BMW. Would you describe the BMW car in the Museum of Modern Art show? It's the Rover Mini Millennium concept car.
Yeah, that is a new version, a concept version of the next century's new Mini. The Mini, as you know, was produced originally in 1959 and is, in a sense, a classic of this genre of the people's car, again, in the spirit of things like the Model T, the Beetle, or the Citroën de Chavot. It was a car that really answered the need in Europe, particularly in England, for simple, affordable transportation. The designer put the engine in horizontally to afford a great deal of space. And if you've ever been in one, it has a tremendous amount of interior space with an extremely small exterior space. And the reason the automobile is in the show, the new concept for it, is that we want to show that these kinds of cars are still very valid, are still very important, and that the redesign of these cars is still an essential topic, in a sense.
Well, Christopher Mount, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thank you.
Christopher Mount organized the show Different Roads, Automobiles for the Next Century at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. A group of car designers, engineers, historians, and sociologists will participate in a symposium at the museum on September 7th. Coming up, we meet car designer Chuck Pelley. This is Fresh Air. Over the past 30 years, Chuck Pelley has designed cars for General Motors, Chrysler, Ford, and Volvo. Now he designs for BMW. He's the president and CEO of DesignWorks USA, which is now owned by BMW. The BMW Mini Millennium concept car is featured in the current Museum of Modern Art show. I asked Pelley about the innovations he's been working on.
The majority of innovations are pieces of electronics and support system for the human. The inside of the car reflecting what's happening in our electronic world, simple things like being on the web and having navigation, are going to be dwarfed by systems that will learn to know you, the black box that keeps track of who you are. And maybe you even take it from car to car, and it gets smarter and smarter as it learns your habits and your unique idiosyncrasies. Good morning, Terry. I see it's Monday, and I can feel that you're a little nervous. I'm going to soften the suspension and play a little quieter music for you.
That's what the black... Tell me what else the black box would do for me.
Well, it certainly could set the seats and the mirrors and the temperature, preset it, and maybe even out-analyze you. Maybe it feels that you're running a little too warm and would lower it, the air conditioning, even more than you would expect.
Can I veto it?
This is the this is the wonderful world that this starts, because veto power sometimes is a lot of work. All these electronic gadgets that work automatically, you have to be rather smart to override, i.e. the windshield wiper works by sensitivity to rain. Well, if a car splashes you with mud, it didn't read it at the sensor, and so you want to override this automatic system and push the darn thing. So the drivers are going to have fewer buttons, but they're going to have to be more clever.
Is there a desire on the part of drivers to have such a black box that makes all these decisions on your behalf?
Once again, this wonderful split that you spoke of earlier of variation in automobiles has happened in this area also. As much as some people love the gee whiz electronics, others love and live for simplicity. They really want to feel the gearbox. They really want to understand what the car is doing and be in touch with it. So we see an expansion on both sides.
So does that mean you have to have like one model for the people who don't like gizmos and another model who for people who are really into electronics?
Isn't that wonderful? It keeps us employed.
So that's a big split in the way people are heading now. Now you mentioned the web being in the car. What I always get scared when I think about people doing things like consulting the internet while they're driving. I mean, what would the web be doing in the car?
Well, if you use voice recognition, and it can be made safe. I mean, you really don't have to interface with small letters in the future. You'll have multiple movement controls that allow you to concentrate on your driving and still communicate with your car. There'll be a whole new world of fancy hand input devices. And the peak of the future, of course, comes from the entertainment industry when you see young kids playing with 15 or 20 buttons on a video game.
So you would imagine people driving and using voice communication with the web to what? To get email or to...
To get email, to stay in communication with their offices or social calls.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly they can get a peek at the traffic ahead mm-hmm. via other people. If someone is a mile ahead on the freeway, they can radio openly. Don't worry, they're pulling the wreck off the road and stay on, even though the traffic report says it's closed. A very quick feedback.
Are prototypes in the works for this?
Yes, everywhere. There's a whole electronic world that's emerging at unbelievable speed. The interesting part of the speed of electronic development is that it's faster than cars develop. So electronics can be outmoded two or three times within the life of a car. We don't quite know how to face this.
Well, another concern I always have when I'm dealing with electronics in a car, and that is, what if the system breaks? Even right. something like electronic locks on your car, you know, if it breaks, how do you get in and out? How do you lock it? Is this a concern of yours? Do you find that the electronic system sometimes fails and it's hard to fix?
Of course. The more you have, the more it can go wrong. And so overrides and mechanical overrides have to be designed. It's a potentially very dangerous problem.
Mm-hmm.
So it just gets more and more complex.
Charles Pelley is my guest. He's the president and CEO of DesignWorks USA, which is a subsidiary of BMW, and he, among other things, designs cars. His company specializes in automotive and industrial design, and one of the BMW cars is represented in the new show at the Museum of Modern Art, which is called Different Roads, Automobiles for the Next Century. You've said identity is very important when it comes to cars. What do you think gives the BMW its identity?
BMW is lucky in this way, in that it's a small company and has identified a certain niche audience. So first of all, it's not addressing a total global audience like a make like Toyota or Chevrolet is. So number one, it can be aimed at the buyer very carefully. The second part is that the precision that the car reflects on the outside is reflecting the engineering-driven premise of the car. And surprisingly, we have a lot of rules that we follow as designers on this car. There's an offset on the fender called the Zika, and we are very careful that this proportionally is always done the same way. The window outline has a dogleg in it, which is always respected. There's a whole series of design lines that we follow as guidelines. They're modified each year, but very, very respected, much like brewing wine or any other luxury item.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about electronics in the car and some of the innovations that are happening in that aspect of automotive design. What about ergonomics inside the car? I mean, a lot of cars now, you can adjust the seat much better than you ever could before. You can raise it up or down. You can, like, blow up the back of the seat to create better lumbar support and so on. What are some of the other ergonomic design changes in the works now?
I feel that the innovation of electronics has gotten really too much play here, and we would like to have it return more to the respect of the people driving the car. We have a long way to go to make controls easier and more functional. I think one of the best examples to see what might be expected in controls in the future is to look at racing cars, especially the Formula or the kart cars. The obvious thing that you see first is a lot of controls on the steering wheel, so that your thumb can hit up to 12 different buttons without moving your eyes, without changing the grip on the steering wheel, without wiggling or moving.
What kind of controls would those be?
Well, they would be speed controls, radio controls, sensors that could increase the boost or turbocharge. In the case of race cars or cars where high mileage is required, you can actually change the timing of the motor from... And, of course, the electronic controls. It's going to be a free-for-all of what gets the priority. Surprisingly, priorities are not what you expect always. We know the speedometer is very important, but you'd never guess what's next important to many people, and that's the thermometer. They want to know what temperature it is outside.
Really?
So there are little unknown things like this that when you study human nature, you know, what do people really want to know when they're going down the street on their way to a job interview?
You know, you mentioned all these other buttons that are likely to end up on the steering wheel. I find that I can't even figure out where the horn is most of the time. You know, like the horn used to be... You used to be a circumference surrounding the whole steering wheel, and now there's often like two little places that you can press to actually get the horn to sound. And I think that's really a problem. Who wants to have to go fishing for the horn when you need it?
Well, you shouldn't use the horn so much. That's
no, it's not a question of so much. It's a question of that one time when you need it, and you need it immediately.
Yeah. I know it's being reduced and continuing to be reduced. It's a matter of real estate value. There's no more room to have a great big horn. It's just going to have to be a button like the other functions. Okay, we'll make it red and easier to hit.
That's a good idea. I have a question about car seats. Car seats often seem to tilt back a bit, when it seems to me that the position of advantage when you're driving would be to be sitting upright and not leaning back. Maybe I say that because I'm short. And I know, like, seeing race car drivers, they always seem to be tilted back, which I've never quite understood either. What's the explanation for that?
Yes. Unfortunately, since cars are made for all sizes of people, small people and big people are compromised. And this is sad. And it's a matter of expense. The pedals should move and move rearward for a small driver so that they're not thrown so close to the steering wheel. And a large driver, of course, needs adjustment. The needs of the driver ergonomically really haven't been met that well.
What are you working on? What would you like to improve?
Well, we'd love to move the pedals. We'd love to move the steering wheel more.
Move it how?
Move it in more directions.
What do you mean?
Up and down, increase the angle. It should be a 5-axis movement.
In other words, we should be able to adjust where the pedals are depending on our size?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So that it's comfortable. And everyone has a different driving style. Some people like to be more upright and others more reclined. And this should be available to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. Once again, it's a challenge area that we can continue to try and improve.
And what else would you like to improve inside the car, in the interior?
Well, storage seems to always be something that's never addressed. As the real estate becomes so important for gadgets and operational...
Oh, and storing the airbags, that takes up a lot of room.
Yes. But people carry a lot of objects into the car, mm-hmm. and certainly even the woman's purse is seldom dealt with logically. And so the use of storage and the development of a more flexible interior. Sometimes you have children with you, and other times you have a piece of sculpture. And it would be nice if the car could respond to that by movement of the chairs or trunks or something to support you. And for that matter, it would be nice if the doors opened a little bit different ways so that you didn't wreck your new shoes getting in or bump your head and, you know, some of these compromises.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chuck Pelley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, you're a delight to talk to.
Chuck Pelley is the president and CEO of DesignWorks USA. He designs cars for BMW. Coming up, a new edition of the classic usage book, The Elements of Style. This is Fresh Air. In commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the birth of the writer E.B. White, there's a new edition of The Elements of Style. That's the classic English usage book that White published in 1959 as an expanded version of a handbook written by his Cornell English professor, William Strunk. Fresh Air's linguist, Jeff Nunberg, has been looking through the new edition and has these thoughts.
The Elements of Style is one of the most unlikely bestsellers of the century, with more than 10 million copies in print. A large proportion of these were purchased by high school and college students at the urging of their English teachers, but its coterie isn't limited to the classroom. It showed up in 21st place on a list compiled by the editors of the Modern Library of the 20th century's 100 best nonfiction books. It came in just behind the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas and well ahead of works by George Orwell, Edmund Wilson, and Bertrand Russell. People talk about it with an almost sacramental piety. In a blurb on the front cover of the new edition, Charles Osgood says that he always carries the book around in his pocket. You have the feeling that if he'd had space, he would have gone on to tell you how it once saved him from being impaled by a pencil that a crazed copy editor had lanced at his heart. This is clearly not a book to tamper with. For the new edition, the publisher has added a gracious introduction by White's stepson, Roger Angel, and a few concessions have been made to modern sensibilities about pronoun gender. But there have been almost no changes in the tractarian tone of the book, which is cast as a list of peremptory dicta like use concrete language or place the emphatic words of the sentence at the end. Like most tracts, The Elements of Style is a simplistic book. As an intellectual or literary work, it scarcely bears comparison with W.H. Fowler's Modern English Usage, published about 30 years earlier, which was conspicuously absent from the Modern Library's top 100. Fowler's book treats style with consistent irony as a complex and subtle problem. There's none of that in The Elements of Style. It sets down its rules as if they were matters of simple common sense. And it's only when you look at the rules closely that you realize how arbitrary and unhelpful most of them really are. Take those general precepts that have endeared the book to generations of copy editors. Be clear, write naturally, work from a suitable design. Who could argue with those principles? We all want to be clear, except perhaps for Alan Greenspan, and nobody wants to be thought of as unnatural, Lord knows. But how exactly are we supposed to get there? It's like opening a book about cooking and finding the injunction, be tasty. And when you look in Strunk and White for more specific advice, you find only a jumble of arbitrary and sometimes questionable prescriptions. The section on word use, for example, consists mostly of a list of those hermetic little fetishes that copy editors have always nurtured in their vitals, most of them without any rational justification. What's wrong with using aggravate to mean irritate, for example? Dickens did it, and so did Kipling, Melville, Shaw, and John Cheever. After 150 years of precedent, it's hard to see how it could be much of an impediment to clear expression. And most of the other rules are equally groundless. Don't use nauseous to mean sick at the stomach. Don't use transpire to mean happen. Don't use alternative when more than two choices are involved. The current edition of the Elements of Style even dutifully retains the admonition about using the verb contact to mean get in touch with, which was a favorite bugbear of critics of the 50s, even though the usage goes back to Dreiser and is completely standard by now. If you really assumed that these rules were just matters of clarity, you'd have to conclude that clarity itself is a pretty mysterious notion. But most young readers are likely to have a more immediate reaction. What's your problem? The book's general advice about usage is no less mystifying. The Elements of Style has probably done more than any other book to popularize those categorical principles like use the active voice, use nouns and verbs rather than adjectives and adverbs, use Anglo-Saxon rather than Latin words. These are the liturgy of the plain style, canonized in dozens of little books modeled on Strunk and White, not to mention the style checkers that come with word processing systems. But no good writer would take them seriously. If you did, after all, you'd wind up denying yourself the use of half of the words and constructions that the English language puts at your disposal. In the end, it's all just special pleading for a particular sort of English style. It's a style that's no less contrived or sophisticated than any other, but it drapes its artifice in a mantle of simplicity. There's plenty of sound advice in the Elements of Style. It was the book that first made me aware of the importance of paring down unnecessary words, saying hostile acts instead of acts of a hostile nature. And it's done a lot to discourage that cumbersome expression, the fact that. But this useful guidance is buried under a heap of lore and superstition, and it's a safe bet that few of the well-known writers who extol the text actually pay heed to most of the advice it offers. Like most religious texts, it's more often recommended than obeyed. That comforting simplicity seems to be just the thing to offer to a beginning writer who's apt to be intimidated by the moral complexities of a Fowler. In its way, the Elements of Style is very like Charlotte's Web, another book that grown-ups love to give to young people. But Charlotte's Web is by far the better work.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolf. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Back Bay Books, publishers of The Pilot's Wife, a novel by Anita Shreve, in paperback in bookstores everywhere, and from Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at VIXX.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
As the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam, Pete Peterson works near the building once known as the Hanoi Hilton, where he was held prisoner of war for over 6 years. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Peterson about his return to Vietnam. He's the subject of a new PBS documentary. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.